I can't accept that. No, that's not right. I can't accept that. Good evening. Welcome to the City of Angels radio show, Families and Recovery. My name is Bill, and I'm here with my lovely wife, Kathy.
How you doing tonight?
Our program is about acceptance. As you see, I couldn't accept my wife's first...
he told me to say hello.
Yeah. Yeah, who knows. Welcome to our show tonight. We want to thank everybody for coming. Our program tonight is acceptance. And Kathy's going to give us a opening charge. We're going to define acceptance. We have my cousin Frank from Chicago with 45 years in addiction therapy and counseling. He'll be joining us. We have a spiritual section on acceptance. And then Kathy will do five stages of grief, which is really about a process to get through acceptance. You'll learn all about that tonight. And then our last section will be on a five keys of accepting what you really cannot change. So we hope you enjoy our program tonight. So, Kath, start us off with your opening charge.
Okay, Bill, thanks for that introduction. I'm going to do the charge about acceptance. So it seems almost too simple to be true, but acceptance, accepting things exactly as they are, can be the key that unlocks the door to happiness. After the scripture verse of John 3:16, where it talks about God so loved the world, there is another passage that may be one of the most quoted passages in literature. And it's on page 417 in the fourth edition of the Alcoholics Anonymous, or the Big Book, as it's widely known. And I added a few things to be applicable to all of our situations, addict and codependence and whoever's in between that. So here's the quote: "And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some facts of my life unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it is supposed to be at the moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Until I could accept my alcoholism, in our case, our codependency, addictions, or our addicted loved ones, we could not say sober or find balance or manageability. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world, as on what needs to be changed in me and in my attitude. For me, serenity began when I learned to distinguish between those things that I could change and those things that I could not change. When I admitted that there were people, places, things, and situations over which I was totally powerless, those things began to lose their power over me. I learned that everyone has the right to make their own mistakes and learn from them without my interference, judgment, or assistance. The key to my serenity is acceptance. But acceptance does not mean that I have to like it, condone it, or even ignore it. What it does mean is that I am powerless to do anything about it. I have to accept that fact. Nor does it mean that I have to accept unacceptable behavior. Today I have choices. I no longer have to accept abuse in any form. I can choose to walk away, even if it means stepping out into the unknown. I no longer have to fear change or the unknown. I can merely accept it as a part of the journey. Sometimes we spend years trying to change things in our lives over which we have no power. We did not know it. We threatened, scolded, manipulated, coerced, pleaded, begged, pouted, bribed, and generally tried everything we could to make the situation better, only to watch as things always got progressively worse. Sometimes we spend so much time trying to change the things we can't change, and never once occurred to us that simply accepting them as they were. Now when things in my life are not going the way I planned them, or downright bad things happen, I can remind myself that whatever is going on is not happening by accident. There's a reason for it, and it is not always meant for me to know what that reason is. That change in attitude has been the key to happiness for me, and I know I am not the only one who has found that serenity. Okay, so now I'm going to take a couple of minutes, Bill, to define what acceptance is from the dictionary standpoint and just a couple of other thoughts that I came up with. So as a verb, acceptance means to agree or consent to accommodate or reconcile oneself to accept the situation. Acceptance as a noun is the act of accepting something or someone. Another definition is acceptance is the willingness to tolerate a difficult situation. We kind of resign ourselves and bow our head and mumble, "I accept," and sigh deeply and let the pain in and move on. So a lot of times when we're resisting acceptance, it means we're trying to avoid some kind of pain. Another definition of is remembering that life is what it is and the situation is what it is. It's a facing of the facts. Dr. Phil always has a line where he says, "Unless I'm honest about the facts, change cannot occur." So we have to acknowledge facts. And a lot of times what we do is we get in a place of trying to change facts or trying to rant and rave about what went wrong, when in reality, there's nothing we can do about it. There's a book called Out of Darkness, and Steve Taylor wrote in that book that those who have gone through trauma and how it transformed their lives, he calls it transformation through suffering, and states that people that were transformed all had clear moments of acceptance. They stopped resisting the reality of the situation they were in. They let go, they surrendered, and it changed them. So recovery requires us to accept life on life's own terms, to accept our powerlessness and our limitations, and to accept those of others. Letting go is not easy. It's a constant challenge for addicts and codependents because our internal anxiety and dis-ease and our illusion that we have control over more than we actually do. When we start to let go, we might feel a tremendous anxiety and often depression and emptiness. But then we begin to feel what our attempts at control have been trying to avoid, and that is what most of us fall into, is we're trying to avoid the fact that we might feel lonely. We might not like the idea that we have some changes that we need to make within ourselves. We might have to grieve for the love that's lost or a person that died. Or we may have to face the fact that our addiction is serious or that of a loved one, his addiction is serious, and that it's possible that they could die over an overdose. So we need to come to a place where we believe that the outcome of this situation is not determined or predicated upon my involvement. I come to believe there is something or someone greater than I at work and involved in the scheme of life. Acceptance isn't something that we can just all of a sudden just do. It's a process that we have to go through. In the next couple of minutes, my husband and I interviewed our cousin Frank from Chicago. If you guys listened to our show from last October, we interviewed him last year, and we wanted him to talk to us about acceptance. Frank has had many years, 40 years, working in the field of addictions and recoveries as a professor, as a counselor, and many other things. And so I'd like to introduce him to you. We're going to talk to him about this topic of acceptance.
Our show this month is on acceptance.
Okay.
And, you know, we went and did some research. I got papers all over the place with ideas, and I could, you know, just read you off some of the titles. But maybe even before we do that, we just talk to you a little bit about, in your therapy work, did you ever work with the concept of acceptance, either with the addict or family members?
And if all the time.
Really? And like
all the time, because, okay, the death and dying model, okay. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, you've probably researched that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, the death and dying model is actually a very accurate model of early recovery in addiction.
You go through the same steps?
They go through the same steps. And there's some danger signs when they go right from denial to acceptance. Mm-hmm. They're not really there. Okay. They're in a kind of a denial in and of itself. But they usually go through bargaining, like Frank, okay, I got to quit drinking, I know, but don't tell me I have to quit smoking pot. I mean, that's nature's way of saying hi. Yeah. I've never gotten any trouble with pot. you know. Mm-hmm. So there's denial, anger, there's bargaining, and then depression. Okay? Mm-hmm. Depression when the realization sinks in that the loss is there.
Yeah, so that depression is associated with almost like grief. Like you said, the dying.
It is grief.
Yeah.
The most intense relationship an addict has is with their drug, not with people.
Wow.
Okay, so to quit is to have their drug die. Mm. And they're going to go through the same types of stages of grief. It is a grief process. And they're in a healthy recovery when they are in acceptance. And I think the support groups and the step working and the counseling and you know, that type of thing will accelerates that process. I mean, they don't have to get suicidal about it or anything, but some do. That's how you can tell that what addicts call contented sobriety or serenity is actually a synonym for the acceptance of the loss of their.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Now, go ahead, Kath. You had it.
Well, how about from the other side, the codependent side, who
the family?
The family who's, you know, addicted to their addict, and how do they work towards the acceptance in their situation?
Because aren't they struggling with acceptance because they're not accepting the condition of their addict? They follow the addict around no matter what day, the morning and night, and they can't let them go, and they pay all their. So aren't they struggling kind of with acceptance?
Yes, except that I think when we talked about this before, there's really not codependent. Okay. It's actually addiction.
Yeah, yeah. I remember you telling us about it. Yeah,
it's a process addiction.
An addict.
Right.
I got it.
And the codependent, quote unquote, which is the popular term, but it's inaccurate, it tends to lessen the severity of that. But the codependent is going through the identical five stages of grief that the addict does. And I guess what her drug of choice is control.
Okay.
So she has to have her control die.
Mm. Wow.
I don't mean a healthy control. I mean choices she makes about her own life. Yeah. But controlling the uncontrollable is what the relational addict is addicted to.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's why we have you have healthy enabling and an unhealthy enabling.
Well, enabling has always been the curse.
Right. Healthy control, unhealthy.
Enabling is support.
So one of the thoughts I had was that change can't begin then until we face the facts of the condition, the situation.
Facing facts as facts.
Yes.
So I would say reducing denial, becoming aware that the 12 steps are in an order that really works. If you look at the first three,
okay,
of the 12, then you understand that our biggest obstacle to change is actually the denial. Because when you're successfully deceiving yourself, you aren't knowing you're doing it. You believe wholeheartedly that this is the fact, not what Bill's saying to me. This is the fact. Okay, so the first steps is to first accept, in a way, to accept that that you're powerless over the addict or over the drug. You don't accept that you're powerless over the drug. You admit it. Admit it happens in the brain. It happens in the head. Once you admit it, you've cracked a little denial. You're going to be pissed. I can never have another drink or drug for the rest of my life. What about my 3-year-old daughter's wedding? How am I going to toast her? You know, all that shit goes on. And so what they do is they, if they can get to the step one, that I'm powerless over this, okay, then they lead into step two, which is, yeah, come to believe that a power greater than me is what I need to get out of this because I can't do it myself.
Yeah.
Right.
I got something more powerful than me. So I need something more powerful than me. And that's what, you know, for the, actually for religious people who choose God, they sort of skip, there's a denial piece in there where they're skipping, all right, you know, you believe in God, you believe in Jesus Christ, I understand that. I know that if you believe in them, that you talk to him, right? Oh, yes, I pray.
Right.
Well, now, how does he talk back to you? How? By the mouths of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, who love you.
Yeah.
So power greater than yourself is actually me.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you combine me and you, Bill, and then yeah. Bill and Kathy and me, and we're in, sitting now in church or a meeting or whatever, we're sitting there, and the five of us or ten of us who care about you mm-hmm. are going to be saying things that are really going to sound wrong.
Yeah.
Non-factual, but that's why step two or three is exist is say, came to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity and turn your will and life over to it. The turnover is, this is going to sound like I have to commit acts of perversion, but I have to commit what feels like acts of perversion. I have to tell people secrets I haven't even told my bartender.
You're right.
Yeah, that either the addict's doing whatever they're doing or the person addicted right. to the addict is out at 2 a.m. chasing, correct. Trying to find them.
Correct. So they're still not in acceptance. They're right. still not in acceptance at that point. But I would argue that change is happening.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a beginning.
Yeah. It's the beginning of change, and changes are happening. And it's really, really important to reinforce and support and praise the tiny beginnings of those steps, because I look at them as bricks in your foundation of sobriety, all right? Every little thing is a brick, and it's as important as every other little thing. So anytime you spend 24 hours sober, mm-hmm. you know, you win the prize. You're awesome job. Well done.
Absolutely.
So I guess that what I'm thinking of is that step one bit, which really is the person trying to admit they have a problem, including the family of the addict, who's their own addict, with the addict.
Yeah.
Tongue twister. Is that
admitting that they have the problem? That see,
because yeah, they don't want to.
Yeah, well,
they can't want to.
They can't want to because mm-hmm. they're just compelled.
Correct. And they're in denial. I mean, you can't make decisions. This is why I don't like blaming people for their addiction and their addiction behavior, because these are not about choices. These are about distorted beliefs and denial patterns that distort their reality so that the decisions that they look like they're making are no more decisions than a knee jerk because they don't have any facts. They don't have any understanding facts. Of what's going on.
A lot of our shows, we'll turn around and kind of frame up to them some facts of what unhealthy behavior may look like. And then, of course, we get into the facts of healthy behavior, what it would look like, and what some steps you could take to move over to a healthier. But I think what I'm hearing you say, especially when, like you said, the facts is that, you know, we're in denial. We're struggling to accept the way we think in relation to our addiction. And really that breakthrough eventually has to come on your own. You're not going to convince them. I'm not going to convince them. I could give them facts. Maybe eventually they soak in.
Well, okay. When you say convince, Bill, there's a danger that you're setting foot inside the codependent model trying to control what someone else thinks. Now, there's a whole mythos about, you know, being able to do that. I mean, spouses of alcoholics believe they could control the drinking if they withhold sex, control the money, do all that stuff.
But Frank, Is there something that acts as the catalyst to help that transformation begin?
Yeah.
What?
Yes.
Themselves?
Yes.
Because you just said, I can't convince.
Bill, you're a minister. Guess what the catalyst is.
Oh. Yeah. God, through inspiration, working on him?
Bingo.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll tell you, a lot of recovering addicts attribute to me magic sentences, mm-hmm. okay, because of something I said to them. However,
it's
in terms
of readiness.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Had to exist, and that would not exist without things going on that none of us even a little can understand and control and manipulate. I mean,
I love that.
I have a little story, and maybe you could help me break it apart. So, for instance, I have a company. And, I'm organizing that company and LCC and getting it established, and I'm going through the criteria to make it official. Meantime, I'm out working on relationships with other companies to partner to move forward and get contracts. Mm-hmm. And I thought that all my paperwork was going to be done that was going to establish the company, make it official while I was working on the relationship with these other companies to put out bids and RFPs, requests for proposals.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing you know, the RFP, request for proposal, occurs. And I call the organization I'm working with to get my company officially set up, and they turn around and say, yeah, we're not going to be able to get it done in time for you. So now I can't do the RFP as a official company. And now I'm all upset. I'm angry, frustrated, sad, just all the feelings of crap. It didn't come together. Isn't acceptance in there somewhere? Because I remember I was talking to the person who was going through this. They say, I'm not ready to accept anything. I'm pissed. I'm mad. And I want to be angry.
Okay. Well, those are. Your learned reactions to a set of distorted beliefs that you have.
Wow.
Okay, and one of them is that you're shooting on either yourself or the bestowers of blessing on your company or whatever. They should not treat me like this. They must respect.
Wow.
They should have had the paperwork done.
They should have had the paperwork done, blah, blah, blah. And shoulds are actually unrealistic demands that you're making that have an effect on your emotions. It's an unreal demand. You didn't. Here's the fact. The fact is the paperwork is not done because the bureaucracy that does it sucks or is slow.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You leave the bureaucracy have the problem of sucking. Don't you start, And so when you do that, you just go, well, there's got to be an alternative. This is a problem that needs a solution.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a problem that, is going to affect my marriage or going to affect my close, loving friends. And this is a problem that is in business, probably, 90% of the time.
Right.
And you, in the anger state and while your distorted beliefs are churning, you're not problem solving. You're venting, doing stuff
Do a lot of people default to that?
Sure. Absolutely.
It's like almost like human nature to default to that, right?
Probably. Well, I don't know if it's human nature. It might have something to do with getting kicked out of gardens or something, but I don't know.
Well, what I was thinking was my wife is always saying to me, well, Bill, you had unrealistic expectations. See, you had expected that you'd put that paperwork in, and even if you put it in a month and a half before the RFP was due, therefore you expected that paperwork was going to get done. So you had expectations that were unrealistic.
Yeah. Okay, they were unrealistic because what makes they may not have been unrealistic at the time you had them because you've heard other people get it done in a month or whatever, and right. So you're you have a reason for that expectation. That's not the problem. The problem is that the reality is it did not happen within the time period you had expected it to, mm-hmm. and you're sort of like making it personal. You're saying they must not do this to me. This is really going to screw me up. I am really going to go. You awfulize, you catastrophize the event instead of looking at it as part of doing business and the problem, which is the reality of business stuff is that there's a ton of Peter principled people out there who are going to have to be taking care of things for you, but they suck at it. Yeah. And so, and they're in denial of sucking at it. So they keep their positions.
The reason I brought it up is because I'm thinking this show, when it comes to acceptance, really crosses over everywhere. It crosses over to the addict. It crosses over to the family of the addict. And guess what?
In general.
It crosses over to the people in general, whether you're an addict or not. And that's why I brought it up. Right. So then that person with the...
And workaholics.
So that person, that scenario I just gave you, they go through the same steps here as far as the denial, the anger,
the five stages of grief. Death and dying is where it comes from.
That's the same thing with that.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, because now they're in denial that it occurred to them, and then they're angry over that it came to them, then they're lashing out at what they don't want to accept that it happened.
Do this. Stop doing don't, because don't is an accusation. Do can't, because the disease or the illness or the process that is screwing them up is beyond their power.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
Now, I have another story, one other one, so that you could help me to see. I'm trying to get, by sharing, I guess, hoping that our listeners could come to a place that says, oh, I maybe a fact or inspiration or something hits them. So
yeah. Now
I'm talking to another guy. He's in jail. This is a true story. And I'm talking to him. He's supposed to go to court. He goes to court. He sits there all day in handcuffs, waits for the whole day. They never get to him. So he comes back, and I'm talking to him after it was supposed to happen. I said, you go? No, I didn't go. He's all mad. I didn't go. I don't know. I sat all day, bang, bang, bang. And so he was going through this anger bit and the whole thing of, I guess, accepting or not accepting that it wasn't taken care of. And then as he's talking to me, he kind of says, oh, while I was there, one of the guys I was talking to, another prisoner, because you're sitting there on a bench with a bunch of prisoners waiting to get up, had to share with me that over in the prison, they changed the way they do business. And now other things will be offered to me that wouldn't have been there 6 months ago. And he's like telling me, like, he's coming up with these positive things about
prison.
Why?
About prison.
Yeah. And the positive things about, I actually didn't get to go to court today, but these other things came out today that really, I'm almost saying, wow, maybe it's good the way the process took. Because if I did get to go 2 months ago, then other policies in the prison would have been in effect, and I may not have been as blessed or benefited from it.
Exactly.
Well, but see what I'm saying? So he was at first angry about the situation and events, and then he transitioned himself to a place of okay with it.
Exactly.
So
that he developed throughout, however, whatever his life is. It's a skill we all need to develop to be able to cope with reality. The better you are at coping with reality, all right, the closer you come to serenity.
Mm-hmm.
And so the skill set that he had is, I can change the way I look at something, because that's about all I can change. I can't change a judge. Mm-hmm. So I can change the way I look at something. How can I look at this to kind of not piss me off so much? You know, mm-hmm. is there any silver lining in this storm cloud? And I should look for it. That's an excellent skill set you would have in any crisis, is to be able to take a look at, how could I think about this situation that would not be as much of a burden to me? And then think of it that way.
Yeah.
So is that also a part of getting towards acceptance of what happened?
Absolutely.
Okay. So facts, and then change a paradigm shift. You heard in a business world, right?
Yeah.
Paradigm shift, the way you look at things. And all of that, the catalyst is that eventually God, through inspiration, can bring it through to you. He uses people such as you and I may throw out, and Kathy, who throw out thoughts, ideas, concepts. But they may or may not land, depending on where you're at. But eventually,
right,
if you're surrendering to a higher power, one of them may hit you in the back of the head one day and say, you know, I finally get it.
Yeah. I always, when I did therapy and when I taught, I always, before I started, took a couple of minutes to invite my higher power to use me.
Yeah.
Okay? That's what I do every time. I was never able to, when he does that or she does that, I'm not always aware that that's what's going on, but, okay, I'm doing my best to be open to allow him to do his work.
Yeah.
And I don't feel his work all the time. I don't feel that going on all the time, but you know, my job, I believe I'm doing okay. I do believe I did my best to have him use me to get his work done.
What I was thinking was, okay, I plant a seed. That's how I always think about it. So you make a statement to somebody. Like I said, on a radio show, we say, here's some facts here. Let me show you some unhealthy behaviors that you may eventually be able to relate to and say, oh, maybe I do have a problem. Here's some healthy behaviors, etc. Oh, I see. So now you see. But I'm only planting seeds. I'm only the vessel through which God is working. And if those seeds are planted, someday they may bear fruit. So like you said, I may not see the result.
Correct. Correct.
At that moment, I'm just trusting it'll do what it does.
It's not important to be. I wouldn't call I'm planting seeds an only thing. I would call that a pretty big thing.
I got
yeah.
you.
Okay? The seed is a big thing.
Well, the reason I say that about the only is because I think one of the issues with dysfunctional addicts, of the addicts, is that I think they have a strong compulsion that they have to fix the person. So that's why I'm saying I only have to plant the seed.
But you know why, don't you?
Why?
Because throughout their learning system, however it was in their dysfunctional family, prior to the addict or whatever, they have at their core a very, very, very strong belief of worthlessness and shame that requires them to fix things to be feeling
okay.
Yep.
Okay. And when your core is shame and guilt, and well, guilt's fine. If you have guilt, is a wonderful thing. It means you have a moral code.
Yeah.
Okay. But the shame piece being, you know, it's not I'm done something bad. I am something bad is the belief in shame. Okay. And so if I keep doing good, which by the way, I've defined as bailing them out, helping this. I don't even know that it's enabling. I think it's something that I'm doing because I'm a martyr, and that's a good thing, you know, martyring yourself in their belief system.
It goes back to
Jesus did it, why shouldn't we? Come on. So okay. So I think that peace is what drives that behavior, and whether you label it healthy or unhealthy, that you're not at the root. The root is the shame. Okay, it's like, you know, if you do this thing, that's not unhealthy behavior. That's something you're doing because you feel ashamed if you don't.
And so
let's talk about feeling ashamed. I mean, to me, that's where I always went. Is I went to the core.
So you went to that core, whether
you went
it was
right to the core,
whether that was the family of the addict or the addict. You were always looking to get to that shame core
to get them to realize that the conclusions they drew based on usually addictions in their parents.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you're a kid, you know, but when you're a kid, the planet revolves around you.
Absolutely.
Two-edged sword. Mm-hmm. The fact that I should be getting everything is the pain in the ass parents feel with kids. But the other end of that sword is that the kids also feel that whatever bad is going on, it's somehow their fault.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think the kid starts out wanting to be bad. I think they start out figuring, oh, my God, you know what?
I am bad.
Well, this is what makes me bad. I can't tell what's good.
Mm-hmm.
I do something and they jump on me. I'm confused. And not, we're talking three, four, five years
yeah.
old, personality development time. I don't have something that enables me to know how to be good that makes me bad.
Yeah.
And that decision, I think, has been made by all of the codependents or all of the people that at their level, somehow or other, they were meant to feel their environment impressed on them that they couldn't tell right from wrong. And that's bad.
And that makes me think about when you're talking like that, I'm thinking about parents modeling to their children healthy behavior.
Correct.
Healthy labels and all this healthy stuff. We had a fellow came out of prison. We had him actually come live with us for 4 months. And this is a guy who served 18 years, you know, grew up in a tumultuous background as a child.
He knows about.
And I'll tell you, in the end, he said, I never knew there was another way to live. And after watching us model for him love and respect, he says, I never heard you curse at each other. I never heard you say a derogatory name to my wife or her back. He says, I never knew there was a different way to live. See, so even at an old age, it was modeled. It makes me think about addicts and the families of addicts is that where are they getting their role models? Where are they going to get those mentors that they can watch and say, oh, and I guess meetings help a little bit, but some of those AA meetings could get stuck in themselves.
They do. I mean, there's unhealthy AA meetings. There's unhealthy everything. But to me, it is the most powerful therapeutic force is modeling.
Mm.
Okay. Yeah. Kids do not buy into what anybody says at any time, but what they do is they watch like a hawk at what the person's doing.
Yeah.
So when they see the hypocrisy, don't you use drugs?
Mm-hmm.
And
it's shit. It leaves them on their own.
Yeah.
So they wind up because they're kids. They make bad decisions. They make uninformed decisions, and they wind up with a sense of inferiority and lack of pieces. Look at it this way. If I said, hey, Bill, you're really cool. You're really a nice guy. I loved your sermon and everything else. You would smile and appreciate that of me. But the difference in power of whether that happens or you go into the bathroom stall and I go into the bathroom with another guy and I go, God, that Bill, he is awesome. Which one has the most power?
The second one.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the power of modeling.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I modeled my appreciation of you as a behavior, not towards you.
Yep.
Yeah.
I got you.
Okay.
Pretty cool.
So that's how, which is why seed planting is about the effort of digging the hole, putting the seed in. The important part of planting the seed isn't your words, okay? It's the bending over, pushing the hole in the dirt, putting the seed in, covering it up, seeing that it's nurtured. That's the power of planting the seed.
That's pretty cool. It's connection with people then.
Connection,
care, love. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Connections with people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, I struggle with acceptance as bad as anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Everything I've told you goes right out of my mind in the middle of a crisis.
Of course. Because we're human.
Okay. And so I have coped Well, by accepting that I'm a fallible human being who makes mistakes, and I'm okay with that, all right? I am not greater than I am, mm-hmm. and I'm okay with that. And that, I think, is a goal for many people who believe either their ego gets in the way and they have to be perfect and better than anybody and they compete to be, you know, number one in this and that. But acceptance is accepting yourself first, accepting who you are with your mistakes, with your flaws. And
yeah, that's what I was thinking. Limitations, whatever.
Yes, limitations. Accepting your limits.
And being okay with that.
And being okay with it and saying, you know, first I better check and make sure that it's not denial. And then if it isn't, then I'll work on it as best as I can.
Yeah.
But it isn't a bad idea that there's an old joke about two psychiatrists meet in an elevator and they go, you're fine, how am I?
Yeah, I have a tendency to do that.
That's okay, because I think that's the key to really building these skills is to always check with someone you trust and love, because that's the person God will be talking through.
Yes. Yeah. That's great advice right there. Because we do need affirmation. And maybe sometimes we surround ourselves with people like-minded so we don't.
We don't get any.
Yeah.
We get stuck. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I love different people.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
I get a lot of.
That goes to trusting the higher power by saying, all right, I'm going to put myself out there and go to a meeting, which my natural impulse would be not to do.
Right.
Because I have my nice environment that I have set up around me that enables me to stay in this place that I am.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And if, you know, am I willing to take a risk to step out and say, hey, why don't you go to a meeting and see if something comes out of that?
It's there because it works the way they want it to work.
That's funny because it goes back to what we were kind of talking about with the addiction and the addict is that, being able to be there for them, to be the action, the support, the love,
right.
The care is just so important for them eventually to be able to trust and move to another phase in life or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. And to me, my favorite people, my teammates, and it's a team. If I don't know something, they come and help me find out. Or
you're more in a social interactive.
Yes,
that's why I like to do. That's why I fit you.
That's right.
Yeah, we've played around with a whole bunch of ideas. Thank you very much. Well, I hope you enjoyed Frank's conversation about acceptance with Kathy and I. Right now, I want to go into our spiritual segment. Actually, is a clip from a sermon that I gave. You'll see it fits right in with what we're talking about with acceptance. Let's play that tape right now for you. Exactly what Adam and Eve were supposed to do, and that was total dependence upon God, to live perfectly in God. Satan says, mankind can't do it, God. See, you've created beings. They cannot live according to the principles of your kingdom. And Jesus says, no, they can. The principle, the great truth I'm sharing with you is Jesus modeled for us total dependence. And that gave him a peace from God. I want to give you an example. I have to share my story of my mother dying. It was very traumatic. I was going to retire. And I preached this sermon 3 days before I was going to retire. Mom was on her deathbed. We thought she was dead that week. My wife just lost her job. I'm going to retire losing half my pay. My mother's dying. Do you think I was distraught? Do you think I felt a little anxiety, fear, abandonment, concerns, stress? What level do you think my faith was at? Probably bouncing along the bottom. My cousin, Frank Salvatini, who's a psychologist, out in Chicago, God sends me, cousin from Chicago, to get me through that moment. So, matter of fact, he had flown this way to visit Mom because he thought we were going to lose her. And we're driving in the car, and he says, how you doing? I said, how am I doing? Not good. Not good. But
you're the preacher man of God, right, Bill? Yeah, not good. Not good. I confess. And you know what he said to me? Talk about truth. He said, worry is a sign that our faith is faltering. Now, punch me here. The preacher man of God he's preaching to. Worry is a sign that our faith is faltering. I said, well, so tell me what else? What more then? You're right. It's my worry is causing, it's got my faith is not strong. He says, and what's the answer and solution? Acceptance. What? Come on. Tell me the truth. We really don't want to accept things, right? Come on. I got to accept I have to have the 1997 model car. I can't have the Jaguar. What, I have to accept that my child may die? That I'm going to lose my mom? That I don't get the job I want? That I got to accept that this person doesn't like me? I got, what? It's against our human nature. It's against the sinful nature. Christ went through all these trials to model for you, me, you and I. That's why he's the apostle and high priest. He went through all the experiences that we've ever go through. And he modeled for us how to handle them. Complete dependence upon God the Father, accepting that whatever comes, the hand of God is with us through it. I said, oh, thanks. So I immediately went to Mom on her deathbed. I said, Mom, I'll be all right. I said, Mom, did you go on to be happy after your mother died? She goes, yeah, I had good times. I said, I'll be all right then. I just found out I could be okay. I'll be okay, even though I'll lose you, Mom. And I told Mom, I said, Mom, it's okay. You can go. I'm 30 years behind you, and then I'll follow you to the grave too. And when our Lord and Savior Jesus raises us up on his second coming, then we'll be reunited. I found peace. Because I accepted the thing I did not want to accept. We all play the victim, don't we? We all play the victim. Not to me. This shouldn't happen to me. Life's not fair. You're right. You're right. In closing, Hebrews 10:35. Listen to what it says. So do not give up your hope, which will be greatly rewarded. Our hope in what? That God will do the work he says he'll do in us. He will teach us, like Jesus had to learn it. Jesus went and learned perfect obedience, surrender to God, for all things to be dependent upon. So we have that great hope that God can do that same work in us. We could become apostles. Now, just a side note for my sister Delissa here. And when we become the apostles, that is our greatest witness. When I say I lost my mom, and I just testified to you that God brought it, that I'm okay. He brought me through it. I want you to know he could bring you through your greatest loss. I'm an apostle of Jesus Christ. I just testified to him. I didn't have to preach you a single doctrine. You could accept Jesus Christ because of the truth I just preached to you just right that moment. That I went through hell, losing my mom. Oh, and God taught me something, brought me through it. He could do the same with you. You see the testimonies? Each one of these had different testimonies, whatever they mean. Betrayal, abandonment, violation of sexual abuse. Every one of you have something that is a testimony to what God can do to bring you through it. So do not give up the hope, which will be greatly rewarded in the end. For having done what is right in God's eyes, dependence and surrender upon him, you have the need of waiting before his word has effect for you. See, he's giving him counsel. He says, you got to have patience. God is going to do a work in you. God is going to sanctify. He's going to cleanse you. We, the upright man, will be living by this faith. That's your challenge today. That we have a Savior who understands every single thing you have ever gone through. Hear that. So next time you're in the midst of throes of anguish, your faith takes a dip, you're all mad, angry, anxious, fearful, check yourself, say, whoa, Wait, let me go back and remember what Bill said. The Savior understands. So he understands what I'm going through right now. So what am I going through? I'm going through this anxiety. Why? My Savior understands anxiety. He was in the garden. Remember, your Savior understands. And through the grace of God, you will become great apostles and witnesses for Him of His work in you to get you through every trial of life.
All right, that ends our spiritual section. And now let's head into the next section with Kathy explaining the five stages of what they call death and dying, or the five stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Kath, it's all yours.
So in the prior section where we were interviewing Frank, he talked about were the five stages of a grief process. And I wanted to kind of go over that with everybody. So that first stage is, the first part of that model is that we go into denial. And that's a useful coping mechanism, and we use that for a little while. It's a defense, and sometimes it makes life a little bit more manageable for the moment. It's a recognition that at the time we're really defiant that we had control over a situation. We really haven't come to accept that we could change things or that things could be different than they are. We're still in that process of just wanting to ignore what really happened. Like, we might say something, well, I don't really want to adjust that right now, so I'm just going to choose denial about it. You know, it helps us deal with a potential threat or uncomfortable facts and feelings. You know, such as I could die from my addiction or my addicted loved one could die. We also really do deny the truth when it puts us in conflict with somebody else. We often use addiction. Addicts and codependents use denial to continue our addictive behavior. Our codependency, we might use it to continue to go and try to bail our loved one out of jail or pay his fines. We really do that not for the other person, but because of our shame and our own belief that we're not okay in ourselves unless we do things for other people. So denial is the first stage. You know, we pretend we just don't want to face up to the facts of what's going on. The next stage that we often get into is anger. So we become angry and we start to blame God. We blame others. We blame the situation. We call people idiots. We're really just trying to find a way to deal with what just happened. And anger keeps us from finding the reality of the situation. But we often go through the anger stage. A lot of times when we're angry, then we start to direct that anger in situations that have nothing to do with the original one that we're having. Like, you know, my friend, he didn't get his court case. So, you know, he could have gotten frustrated about that and then gone back to his house, or in this case, back to jail, and start beating everybody up. And so, you know, that anger, although it was real about the situation, sometimes we end up using our anger in ways that creates worse situations. So we have to be aware that we're going to have the anger, but we're going to have to be really conscious of the fact that could contribute to the problem that we have right now, and to kind of try to focus our anger and to pay attention to it and to turn more towards accepting the facts that we can't deny anymore what's going on. So then we moved into the place of bargaining, and this is one of the first steps of coming out of denial, and it's still merely an attempt to postpone acceptance. So what we do is we attempt to strike a bargain with life, ourselves, another person, or God. If we do such and such, or if someone else does this or that, then we won't have to suffer the loss of whatever didn't happen that we wanted to happen. We're not attempting to postpone the inevitable. We were just attempting to prevent it. So then the next step is grief or depression or both. So we have a feeling of grief, and this is normal. It's a normal response to the loss of anything that we have considered to be important in our life. When we decide to acknowledge what life has sucked to us, we become sad and sometimes really depressed. This is the essence of grief, mourning at its fullest. This is what we have been attempting to avoid at all costs. Now we cry, and it's very painful. but now we are moving closer to acceptance. So the grief and the depression, although that is what we try to avoid, I know for myself a lot of times the avoidance and the trying to not feel the feelings ends up being a lot worse than when I actually do feel the feelings. I get in a place of fear of feeling, and then I'm fearful of the fear, and I just get myself in a real loop where sometimes when I just say this sucks, I don't like it, and I just go ahead and feel my feelings and let it all out and just realize that this is what life's given me right now. I do feel better after having felt those feelings. And then we come to the last stage, which is what our show's been about. And as you can see, it takes a lot to get there. And that is acceptance. After we've closed our eyes, kicked, screamed, negotiated, and finally felt the pain, we have arrived at a state of acceptance. It is not a resigned and a hopeless giving up or a sense of what's the use or I just can't fight it any longer. Though we've heard such statements too, this indicates the beginning of the end of the struggle. We begin to be at peace with what is. We are free to stay or go on. We have accepted what is. Not only are we comfortable with our circumstances and the change we have endured, but we believe we have in some way benefited from the loss or the change, even if we cannot fully understand how or why. Our faith continues to kick in with our higher power that all is well and that we have grown from this experience. And we end up deeply believing that our present circumstance, every details of them, are exactly as they ought to be for the moment. We accept what is and we settle down. So those are the five grief process steps that we have to go through to reach, you know, to reach to the place of acceptance. One of the last sections that I wanted to talk a little bit about is how do we reach acceptance and five keys to accepting what we can't change. So actually, it seems that we actually need acceptance in order to welcome change in our lives. And I don't like change, so I have a hard time with accepting things. We know the serenity prayer is, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. You know, that basically tells us that in order to accept, we need to know what we can change and, more importantly, what we cannot change. So we're in a situation we need to ask ourselves, can I change this? Another thing that we can do while we're in the midst of a situation is, what can we learn or what is the lesson or the gift in the present situation that we're in? It's something that we talked about in our discussion with Frank about our friend who's in jail and how he was upset about his court, but then he started to realize, well, I learned this and I learned that, and he started to see that although he was still sad and upset about and angry about the court, but he did find a valuable gift in that particular situation and things he might not have learned otherwise. So do you find yourself trying to change things you have no control over? If so, you probably find it difficult to be satisfied and content with life. If we can't change a situation or outcome, our best option is to learn how to accept it and deal with it. You know, acceptance has quite a bit of benefits. And it gives us a more positive attitude. We worry less and have less stress. We use less energy from trying to figure everything out that we can't figure out even if we tried. It gives us an ability to embrace change. It helps us to have a greater appreciation and gratitude in life and a more compassionate perspective. And we continue to push forward despite accepting that there are things beyond our control. So here's a few tips to help us live with a greater sense of acceptance. Number one is letting go of the past. Now, in my recovery, I really never liked this saying because it always sounded to me like everybody was telling me to not pay attention and not address what happened to me in my past. So that's not what this means here. What it means is letting go of the past means that we're going to have to address, process, understand what happened in our past, grieve through the losses, take responsibility for our lives regardless of what happened in our past, and move forward. So we can't change the past. So our only hope is to learn how to accept and move past and move forward. The only way we can do that is to really process through it. So part of the acceptance process is learning a new way to cope with a crisis. Again, we learned that instead of, you know, kicking the dog because we're angry, or in my husband's case, yelling or kicking at my cats, which of course he doesn't do, but he always threatens, we need to learn that when we're angry about a particular situation, we don't need to make another situation terrible. So we need to learn different coping skills to cope with situations. And then another one is to make what we're going through in life meaningful. Because we have to realize that some of the worst things that have happened to us end up being the most fundamental parts of our personal growth. You know, the hardest things that we experience, if we open up ourselves to that experience and be willing to see, because we trust our higher power has brought this in our life for a reason, then we're going to have to see that there's probably growth that we can develop and that we can learn from this and have in our life. So what can we learn from our difficulties? And how have our difficulties made us a stronger person? Viktor Frankl says that when we can no longer change a situation, we are challenged to change ourselves. Another way to deal with acceptance and everything is to expect less. One of my lines that I like to tell my friends is to lower your expectations. Sometimes we're surprised over and over and over again when the same people do the same things over and over, and we still become amazed that they did it and upset, that they just couldn't follow through or that they couldn't do more than what they've done in the past. And so I always ask people to lower their expectations. You know, life can appear to be purposeless, unfair, and ruthless if our expectations are unrealistic. So instead of expecting something to happen or expecting a person to act a certain way, try to focus on accepting and creating. Most of the times that we get upset, you know, we're flying or going to fly and there's a delay. Well, the reason that we get very upset is because we expected the delay to not happen. Or my sister continues to put me down when I'm in a situation, and every time I'm there, she does it again, and I'm like, I can't believe she did that. Well, I need to start to realize that what she's going to do, and to start to find ways to take care of myself by maybe telling her that's unacceptable. You know, not being a victim, speaking up for myself. It really is about expecting less. And then we're not as disappointed in life because we realize that our expectations might be more than what were necessary to be happy. And another one is to set new goals. You know, sometimes something that we really wanted to happen didn't happen, and it's not going to happen. So sometimes we have to move on and let go of what we wanted. So let's not get caught in the outcome. You know, instead of doing the same thing and expecting different results, accept that things aren't working the way I planned and do something different. It doesn't mean that just because certain things don't work out in our lives, certain goals that we set didn't work out, it doesn't mean that we can't live productive, meaningful lives. It's just that there's a change that takes place. So we can adapt and adjust to our present situation, and we stop trying to avoid difficult issues and only focusing on what we can't change. So I think those are the five steps that we can use to learn how to accept what we can't change.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed our radio show tonight on acceptance. I hope you've been able to accept some of the stuff that we communicated and shared with you here tonight. God bless. We'll see you next month. Thank you.